economic alliances. That, sir, is something left to the EEC, but America will encourage our European friends to welcome you completely into the European community and offer all influence we can muster to that end.
What do you ask in return? Grushevoy asked.
Golovko hadn't offered that prediction. This could be the answer to many Russian prayers, though his mind made the leap to see that Russian oil would be a major boon to Europe, and hence a matter of mutual, not unilateral, profit.
We ask for nothing special in return. It is in the American interest to help make a stable and peaceful world. We welcome Russia into that world. Friendship between your people and ours is desirable to everyone, is it not?
And in our friendship is profit also for America, Golovko pointed out.
Adler sat back and smiled agreement.
Of course. Russia will sell things to America, and America will sell things to Russia. We will become neighbors in the global village, friendly neighbors. We will compete economically, giving and taking from each other, as we do with many other countries.
The offer you make, is this simple? Grushevoy asked.
Should it be more complicated? The sextate asked.
I am a diplomat, not a lawyer. I prefer simple things to complex ones.
Grushevoy considered all this for half a minute or so. Usually diplomatic negotiations lasted weeks or months to do even the simplest of things. But Adler was right. Simple was better than complex. And the fundamental issue here was simple, though the downstream consequences might be breathtaking. America offered salvation to Russia, not just a military alliance, but the opening of all doors to economic development. America and Europe would partner with the Russian Federation, creating what could become both an open and integrated community to span the Northern Hemisphere. It stood to make Eduard Petrovich Grushevoy the Russian who brought his country a full century into the present-slash-future of the world. And for all the statues of Lenin and Stalin that had been toppled, well, maybe some of his own likeness would be erected. It was a thought to appeal to a Russian politician. And after a few minutes, he extended his hand across the low table of tea things.
The Russian Federation gladly accepts the offer of the United States of America. Together we once defeated the greatest threat to human culture. Perhaps we can do so again. Better yet, together we may forestall it.
In that case, sir, I will report your agreement to my president.
Adler checked his watch.
It had taken 20 minutes.
Damn, you could make history in a hurry when you had your act together, couldn't you?
He stood.
I must be off, then, to make my report.
Please convey my respects to President Ryan. We will do our best to be worthy allies to your country.
He and I have no doubts of that, Mr. President.
Adler shook hands with Golovko and walked to the door. 3 minutes after that, he was back in his car and heading back to the airport. Once there, the aircraft had barely begun to taxi when he got on the secure satellite phone.
Mr. President, Andrea said, coming up to Ryan just as the plenary session of the NATO chiefs was about to begin. She handed over the secure portable phone.
It's Secretary Adler.
Ryan took the phone at once.
Scott? Jack here. What gives?
It's a done deal, Jack.
Okay, now I have to sell it to these guys.
Good job, Scott.
Hurry back.
We're rolling now, sir.
The line went dead. Ryan tossed the phone to Special Agent Price O'Day.
Good news? She asked.
Yep.
Ryan nodded and walked into the conference room.
Mr. President,
Sir Basil Charleston came up to him.
The chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service, he'd known Ryan longer than anyone else in the room had. One odd result of Ryan's path to the presidency was that the people who knew him best were all spooks, mainly NATO ones, and these found themselves advising their chiefs of government on how to deal with America. Sir Basil had served no less than 5 prime ministers of Her Majesty's government, but now he was in rather a higher position than before.
"Baz, how are you?"
"Doing quite well, thank you. May I ask a question?"
"Sure."
But I don't have to answer it, Jack's smile added in reply.
Adler is in Moscow now. Can we know why?
How will your PM react to inviting Russia into NATO?
That made Basil blink, Ryan saw.
It wasn't often that you could catch this guy unawares. Instantly, his mind went into overdrive to analyze the new situation.
China? He asked after about 6 seconds.
Jack nodded.
Yeah, we may have some problems there.
Not going north, are they?
They're thinking about it, Ryan replied.
How good is your information on that question?
You know about the Russian gold strike, right?
Oh, yes, Mr. President. Ivan's been bloody lucky on both scores.
Our intel strike in Beijing is even better.
Indeed, Charleston observed,
letting Jack know that the SIS had also been pretty much shut out there.
Indeed, Baz. It's Class A information, and it has us worried. We're hoping that pulling Russia into NATO can scare them off. Grushevoy just agreed on it. How do you suppose the rest of these folks will react to it?
They'll react cautiously, but favorably, after they've had a chance to consider it.
Will Britain back us on this play? Ryan asked.
I must speak with the PM. I'll let you know.
With that, Sir Basil walked over to where the British Prime Minister was chatting with the German Foreign Minister. Charleston dragged him off and spoke quietly into his ear. Instantly, the Prime Minister's eyes, flaring a little wide, shot over to Ryan. The British PM was somewhat trapped, somewhat unpleasantly because of the surprise factor. But the substance of the trap was that Britain and America always supported each other. The special relationship was as alive and well today as it had been under the governments of Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. It was one of the few constants in the diplomatic world for both countries, and it belied Kissinger's dictum that great nations didn't have friendships, but rather interests. Perhaps it was the exception proving the rule, but if so, exception it was. Both Britain and America would hurl themselves in front of a train for the other. The fact that in England President Ryan was Sir John Ryan, KCVO, made the alliance even more firm. In acknowledgment of that, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom walked over to the American Chief of State.
Jack, will you let us in on this development?
Insofar as I can. I may give Basil a little more on the side, but yeah, Tony, this is for real, and we're damned worried about it.
The gold and the oil? The PM asked.
They seem to think they're in an economic box. They're just about out of hard currency, and they're hurting for oil and wheat.
You can't make an arrangement for that.
After what they did? Congress would hang me from the nearest lamppost.
Quite, the Brit had to agree.
BBC had run its own news miniseries on human rights in the PRC, and the Chinese hadn't come off very well. Indeed, despising China was the new European sport, which hadn't helped their foreign currency holdings at all. As China had trapped themselves, so the Western nations had been perversely co-opted into building the wall. The citizens of these democracies wouldn't stand for economic or trade concessions any more than the Chinese Politburo could see its way to making the political sort.
Rather like Greek tragedy, isn't it, Jack?
Yeah, Tony, and our tragic flaw is adherence to human rights. Hell of a situation, isn't it?
And you're hoping that bringing Russia into NATO will give them pause?
If there's a better card to play, I haven't seen it in my deck, man.
How set are they on the path?
Unknown. Our intelligence on this is very good, but we have to be careful making use of it. It could get people killed, and deny us the information we need.
Like our chap Penkovsky in the 1960s.
One thing about Sir Basil, he knew how to educate his bosses on how the business of intelligence worked. Ryan nodded, then proceeded with a little of his own disinformation. It was business, and Basil would understand.
Exactly. I can't have that man's life on my conscience, Tony, and so I have to treat this information very carefully.
Quite so, Jack. I understand fully.
Will you support us on this?
The PM nodded at once.
Yes, old boy, we must, mustn't we?
Thanks, pal.
Ryan patted him on the shoulder.
Chapter 44 The Shape of a New World Order. It took all day, lengthening what was supposed to have been a pro forma meeting of the NATO chiefs into a minor marathon. It took all of Scott Adler's powers of persuasion to smooth things over with the various foreign ministers. But with the assistance of Britain, whose diplomacy had always been of the Rolls-Royce class, after 4 hours there was a head nod and handshake agreement, and the diplomatic technicians were sent off to prepare the documents. All this was accomplished behind closed doors, with no opportunity for a press leak. And so when the various government leaders made it outside, the media learned of it like a thunderbolt from a clear sky. What they did not learn was the real reason for the action. They were told it had to do with the new economic promise in the Russian Federation, which seemed reasonable enough, and when you came down to it, was the root cause in any case. In fact, most of the NATO partners didn't know the whole story either. The new American intelligence was directly shared only with Britain, though France and Germany were given some indications of America's cause for concern. For the rest, the simple logic of the situation was enough to offer appeal. It would look good in the press, and for most politicians all over the world, that was sufficient to make them doff their clothes and run about a public square naked. Secretary Adler cautioned his president about the dangers of drawing sovereign nations into treaty obligations without telling them all the reasons behind them. But even he agreed that there was little other choice in the matter. Besides, there was a built-in escape clause that the media wouldn't see at first, and hopefully, neither would the Chinese. The media got the story out in time for the evening news broadcasts in America and the late-night ones in Europe, and the TV cameras showed the arrival of the various VIPs at the official dinner in Warsaw. "I owe you one, Tony," Ryan told the British Prime Minister with a salute of his wine glass. The white wine was French, from the Loire Valley, and excellent. The hard liquor of the night had been an equally fine Polish vodka. "Well, one can hope that it gives our Chinese friends pause. When will Grushevoy arrive?" "Tomorrow afternoon, followed by more drinking. Vodka again, I suppose." The documents were being printed up at this very moment, and then would be bound in fine leather, as such important documents invariably were, after which they'd be tucked away in various dusty basement archives, rarely to be seen by the eyes of men again. "Basil tells me that your intelligence information is unusually good, and rather frightening," the PM observed, with a sip of his own. "It is all of that, my friend. You know, we're supposed to think that this war business is a thing of the past." "So they thought 100 years ago, Jack. It didn't quite work out that way, did it?" "True, but that was then, and this is now. And the world really has changed in the past 100 years. I hope that is a matter of some comfort to Franz Ferdinand, and the 10 million or so chaps who died as an indirect result of his demise, not to mention Act Two of the Great European Civil War," the Prime Minister observed. "Yeah, day after tomorrow I'm going down to Auschwitz. That ought to be fun." Ryan didn't really want to go, but he figured it was something of an obligation under the circumstances. And besides, Arnie thought it would look good on TV, which was why he did a lot of the things he did. "Do watch out for the ghosts, old boy. I should think there are a number of them there." "I'll let you know," Ryan promised. Would it be like Dickens's A Christmas Carol, he wondered? The ghost of horrors past, accompanied by the ghost of horrors present, and finally the ghost of horrors yet to be. But he was in the business of preventing such things. That's what the people of his country paid him for. Maybe $250,000 a year wasn't much for a guy who'd twice made a good living in the trading business, but it was a damn sight more than most of the taxpayers made, and they gave it to him in return for his work. That made the obligation as sacred as a vow sworn to God's own face. Auschwitz had happened because other men hadn't recognized their obligation to the people whom they had been supposed to serve. Or something like that.
Ryan had never quite made the leap of imagination necessary to understand the thought processes of dictators. Maybe Caligula had really figured that the lives of the Roman people were his possessions to use and discard like peanut shells. Maybe Hitler had thought that the German people existed only to serve his ambition to enter the history books. And if so, sure enough it had happened, just not quite the way he'd hoped it would. Jack Ryan knew objectively that he'd be in various history books, but he tried to avoid thinking about what future generations would make of him. Just surviving in his job from day to day was difficult enough. The problem with history was that you couldn't transport yourself into the future so that you could look back with detachment and see what the hell you were supposed to do. No, making history was a damn sight harder than studying it, and so he decided to avoid thinking about it altogether. He wouldn't be around to know what the future thought anyway, so there was no sense in worrying about it, was there? He had his own conscience to keep him awake at night, and that was hard enough. Looking around the room, he could see the chiefs of government of more than 15 countries, from Little Iceland to the Netherlands to Turkey. He was president of the United States of America, by far the largest and most powerful country of the NATO alliance. Until tomorrow, anyway, he corrected himself. And he wanted to take them all aside and ask each one how the hell he—they were all men at the moment—reconciled himself and his duties. How did you do the job honorably? How did you look after the needs of every citizen? Ryan knew that he couldn't reasonably expect to be universally loved. Arnie had told him that he only needed to be liked, not loved, by half plus one of the voters in America. But there had to be more to the job than that, didn't there? He knew all of his fellow chief executives by name and sight, and he'd been briefed in on each man's character. That one there, he had a mistress only 19 years old. That one drank like a fish. That one had a little confusion about his sexual preference. And that one was a crook who'd enriched himself hugely on the government payroll. But they were all allies of his country, and therefore they were officially his friends. And so Jack had to ignore what he knew of them and treat them like what they appeared to be rather than what they really were. And the really funny part of that was that they felt themselves to be his superiors, because they were better politicians than he was. And the funniest part of all was that they were right. They were better politicians than he was, Ryan thought, sipping his wine. The British Prime Minister walked off to see his Norwegian counterpart, as Kathy Ryan rejoined her husband. "Well, honey, how did it go?" "The usual. Politics. Don't any of these women have a real job?" she asked the heir. "Some do," Jack remembered from his briefings. "Some even have kids." "Mainly grandkids. I'm not old enough for that yet, thank God." "Sorry, babe, but there are advantages to being young and beautiful," POTUS told FLOTUS. "And you're the best-looking guy here," Kathy replied with a smile. "But I'm too tired. Long day at the bargaining table." "Why are you bringing Russia into NATO?" "To stop a war with China," Jack replied honestly. It was time she knew. The answer to her question got her attention. "What?" "I'll fill you in later, babe, but that's the short version."
"A war?"
"Yeah. It's a long story, and we hope that what we agreed to do today will prevent it."
"You say so," Kathy Ryan observed dubiously.
"Meet anybody you like?"
"The French president is very charming."
"Oh, yeah? He was a son of a bitch in the negotiating session today. Maybe he's just trying to get in your knickers," Jack told his wife. He'd been briefed in on the French president, and he was reputed to be a man of commendable vigor, as the State Department report delicately put it. Well, the French had a reputation as great lovers, didn't they?
"I'm spoke for, Sir John," she reminded him.
"And so am I, my lady." He could have Roy Altman shoot the Frenchman for making a move on his wife, Ryan thought with amusement, but that would cause a diplomatic incident,
and Scott Adler always got upset about those.
Jack checked his watch. It was about time to call this one a day. Soon some diplomat would make a discreet announcement that would end the evening. Jack hadn't danced with his wife. The sad truth was that Jack couldn't dance a lick, which was a source of minor contention with his wife, and a shortcoming he planned to correct some day. Maybe. The party broke up on time. The embassy had comfortable quarters, and Ryan found his way to the king-sized bed brought in for his and Kathy's use. Bondarenko's official residence at Chabarsaville was a very comfortable one, befitting a four-star resident and his family. But his wife didn't like it. Eastern Siberia lacked the social life of Moscow, and besides, one of their daughters was 9 months pregnant, and his wife was in St. Petersburg to be there when the baby arrived. The front of the house overlooked a large parade ground. The back, where his bedroom was, looked into the pine forests that made up most of this province. He had a large personal staff to look after his needs. That included a particularly skilled cook and communications people. It was one of the latter who knocked on his bedroom door at 3 in the local morning.
"Yes, what is it?"
"An urgent communication for you, Comrade General," the voice answered.
"Very well, wait a minute."
Gennady Yosifovich rose and donned a cloth robe, punching on a light as he went to open the door. He grumbled as any man would at the loss of sleep, but generals had to expect this sort of thing. He opened the door without a snarl at the NCO who handed over the telex.
"Urgent. From Moscow," the sergeant emphasized. "Da, spasibo," the general replied, taking it and walking back toward his bed.
He sat in the comfortable chair that he usually dumped his tunic on and picked up the reading glasses that he didn't actually need, but which made reading easier in the semi-darkness. It was something urgent. Well, urgent enough to wake him up in the middle of the fucking...
"My God,"
Sink Far East breathed to himself, halfway down the cover sheet. Then he flipped it over to read the substance of the report. In America, it would be called a Special National Intelligence Estimate. Bondarenko had seen them before, even helped draft some, but never one like this. "It is believed that there is an imminent danger of war between Russia and the People's Republic of China. The Chinese objective in offensive operations will be to seize the newly discovered gold and oil deposits in eastern Siberia by rapid mechanized assault north from their border west of Khabarovsk. The leading elements will include the 34th Shock Army, a Type A group army. This intelligence estimate is based upon national intelligence assets with access to the political leaders of the PRC, and the quality of the intelligence is graded 1A, the report went on, meaning that the SVR regarded it as holy writ. Bondarenko hadn't seen that happen very much. Far East Command is directed to make all preparations to meet and repel such an attack."
"With what?"
the general asked, the papers in his hand.
"With what, comrades?"
With that, he lifted the bedside phone.
"I want my staff together in 40 minutes, he told the sergeant who answered.
He would not take the theatrical step of calling a full alert just yet. That would follow his staff meeting. Already his mind was examining the problem. It would continue to do so as he urinated, then shaved, his mind running in small circles, a fact which he recognized but couldn't change. And the fact that he couldn't change it didn't slow the process one small bit. The problem he faced as he scraped the whiskers from his face was not an easy one, perhaps an impossible one. But his four-star rank made it his problem, and he didn't want to be remembered by future Russian military students as the general who'd not been up to the task of defending his country against a foreign invasion. He was here, Bondarenko told himself, because he was the best operational thinker his country had. He'd faced battle before, and comported himself well enough not only to live, but to wear his nation's highest decorations for bravery. He'd studied military history his whole life.
He'd even spent time with the Americans at their battle laboratory in California, something he lusted to copy and recreate in Russia as the best possible way to prepare soldiers for battle, but which his country couldn't begin to afford for years. He had the knowledge. He had the nerve. What he lacked were the assets. But history was not made by soldiers who had what they needed, but by those who did not. When the soldiers had enough, the political leaders went into the books. Gennady Yosifovich was a soldier, and a Russian soldier. His country was always taken by surprise, because for whatever reason her political leaders didn't ever see war coming. And because of that, soldiers had to pay the price. A distant voice told him that at least he wouldn't be shot for failure. Stalin was long dead, and with him the ethos of punishing those whom he had failed to warn or prepare. But Bondarenko didn't listen to that voice. Failure was too bitter an alternative for him to consider while he lived. The Special National Intelligence Estimate made its way to American forces in Europe and the Pacific even more quickly than to Chabarsaville. For Admiral Bartolomeo Vito Mancuso, it came before a scheduled dinner with the governor of Hawaii. His public affairs officer had to knock that one back a few hours while SyncPAC called his staff together. "Talk to me, Mike," Mancuso commanded his J-2, B.G. Michael Lahr. "Well, it hasn't come totally out of left field, sir," the theater intelligence coordinator replied. "I don't know anything about the source of the intelligence, but it looks like high-level human intelligence, probably with a political point of origin. CIA says it's highly reliable, and Director Foley is pretty good. So we have to take this one very seriously." Lahr paused for a sip of water. "Okay, what we know is that the PRC is looking with envious eyes at the Russian mineral discoveries in the central and northern parts of eastern Siberia. That plays into the economic problems they got faced with after the killings in Beijing caused the break in trade talks, and it also appears that their other trading partners are backing away from them as well. So the Chinese now find themselves in a really tight economic corner, and that's been a casus belli as far back as we have written history." "What can we do to scare them off?" asked the general commanding Pacific Fleet Marine Force. "What we're doing tomorrow is to make the Russian Federation part of NATO. Russian President Grushevoy will be flying to Warsaw in a few hours to sign the North Atlantic Treaty. That makes Russia an ally of the United States of America, and of all the NATO members. So the thinking is that if China moves, they're not just taking on Russia, but all the rest of the North Atlantic Council as well. And that ought to give them pause." "And if it doesn't?" Mancuso asked. As a theater commander-in-chief, he was paid to consider diplomatic failure rather than success. "Then, sir, if the Chinese strike north, we have a shooting war on the Asian mainland between the People's Republic of China and an American ally. That means we're going to war." "Do we have any guidance from Washington along those lines?" SyncPAC asked. Lahr shook his head. "Not yet, Admiral. It's developing a little fast for that. And Secretary Brentano is looking to us for ideas." Mancuso nodded. "Okay, what can we do? What kind of shape are we in?" The four-star commanding 7th Fleet leaned forward. "I'm in pretty decent shape. My carriers are all available, or nearly so. But my aviators could use some more training time. Surface assets? Well, Ed?" Vice Admiral Goldsmith looked over to his boss. "We're good, Bart." Comsub-PAC nodded. "It'll take a little time to surge more of my boats west, but they're trained up, and we can give their navy a major bellyache if we have to." Then eyes turned to the Marine. "I hope you're not going to tell me to invade the Chinese mainland with one division," he observed. "Besides, all of Pacific Fleet didn't have enough amphibious warfare ships to land more than a brigade landing force, and they knew that. Good as the Marines were, they couldn't take on the entire People's Liberation Army."
"What sort of shape are the Russians in?" 7th Fleet asked General Lahr.
"Not good, sir. Their new commander far east is well regarded, but he's hurting for assets. The PLA has him outnumbered a good 8-1, probably more. So the Russians don't have much in the way of deep strike capabilities, and just defending themselves against air attack is going to be a stretch."
"That's a fact," agreed the general commanding the Air Force assets in the Pacific Theater. "Ivan's pissed away a lot of his available assets dealing with the Chechens. Most of their aircraft are grounded with maintenance problems. That means his drivers aren't getting the stick time they need to be proficient airmen. The Chinese, on the other hand, have been training pretty well for several years. I'd say their Air Force component is in pretty good shape."
"What can we move west with?"
"A lot," the USAF four-star answered. "But will it be enough? Depends on a lot of variables. It'll be nice to have your carriers around to back us up."
Which was unusually gracious of the United States Air Force.
"Okay," Mancuso said next. "I want to see some options. Mike, let's firm up our intelligence estimates on what the Chinese are capable of, first of all, and second, what they're thinking. The agency is altering the tasking of its satellites. We ought to be getting a lot of overhead soon, plus our friends on Taiwan. They keep a pretty good eye on things for us."
"Are they in on this SNE?" 7th Fleet asked.
Lahr shook his head.
"No, not yet. This stuff is being held pretty close."
"Might want to tell Washington that they have a better feel for Beijing's internal politics than we do," the senior Marine observed. "They ought to. They speak the same language. Same thought processes and stuff. Taiwan ought to be a prime asset to us."
"Maybe, maybe not," Lahr countered.
"If a shooting war starts, they won't jump in for the fun of it. Sure, they're our friends, but they don't really have a dog in this fight yet, and the smart play for them is to play it cautious. They'll go to a high alert status, but they will not commence offensive operations on their own hook."
"Will we really back the Russians if it comes to that? More to the point, will the Chinese regard that as a credible option on our part?"
Comairpak asked. He administratively owned the carriers and naval air wings. Getting them trained was his job.
"Reading their minds is CIA's job, not ours," Lahr answered. "As far as I know, DIA has no high-quality sources in Beijing, except what we get from intercepts out of Fort Meade. If you're asking me for a personal opinion, well, we have to remember that their political assessments are made by Maoist politicians who tend to see things their own way rather than with what we would term an objective outlook. Short version, I don't know, and I don't know anyone who does. But the asset that got us this information tells us that they're serious about this possible move. Serious enough to bring Russia into NATO. You could call that rather a desperate move towards deterring the PRC, Admiral."
"So we regard war as a highly possible eventuality?" Mancuso summarized.
"Yes, sir," Lahr agreed.
"Okay, gentlemen, then we treat it that way. I want plans and options for giving our Chinese brethren a bellyache. Rough outlines after lunch tomorrow and firm options in 48 hours. Questions?"
There were none.
"Okay, let's get to work on this." Al Gregory was working late. A computer software expert, he was accustomed to working odd hours, and this was no exception. At the moment, he was aboard USS Gettysburg, an Aegis-class cruiser. The ship was not in the water, but rather in dry dock, sitting on a collection of wooden blocks while undergoing propeller replacement. Gettysburg had tangled with a buoy that had parted its mooring chain and drifted into the fairway, rather to the detriment of the cruiser's port screw. The yard was taking its time to do the replacement because the ship's engines were about due for programmed maintenance anyway. This was good for the crew. Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, part of the Norfolk Naval Base Complex, wasn't exactly a garden spot, but it was where most of the crew's families lived, and that made it attractive enough. Gregory was in the ship's CIC, or Combat Information Center, the compartment from which the captain fought the ship. All the weapon systems were controlled from this large space.
The spy radar display was found on three side-by-side displays about the size of a good big-screen TV. The problem was the computers that drove the systems.
"You know," Gregory observed to the senior chief who maintained the systems, "an old iMac has a ton more power than this."
"Doc, this system is the flower of 1975 technology," the senior chief protested. "And it ain't all that hard to track a missile, is it?"
"Besides, Dr. Gregory," another chief put it, "that radar of mine is still the best fucking system ever put to sea."
"Well, that's a fact," Gregory had to agree.
The solid-state components could combine to blast 6 megawatts of RF power down a 1-degree line of bearing, enough to make a helicopter pilot, for example, produce what cruel physicians called FLKs, funny-looking kids, and more than enough to track a ballistic reentry vehicle at 1,000 miles or more. The limitation there also was computer software, which was the new gold standard in just about every weapons system in the world.
"So when you want to track an RV, what do you do?"
"We call it inserting the chip," the senior chief answered.
"What? It's hardware?" Al asked.
He had trouble believing that. This wasn't a computer that you slid aboard into.
"No, sir, it's software. We upload a different control program."
"Why do you need a second program for that? Can't your regular one track airplanes and missiles?" the TRW vice president demanded.
"Sir, I just maintain and operate the bitch. I don't design the things. RCA and IBM do that."
"Shit," Gregory observed.
"You could talk to Lieutenant Olson," the other chief thought aloud. "He's a Dartmouth boy. Pretty smart for a JG.
"Yeah," the first chief agreed. "He writes software as sort of a hobby."
"Dennis the Menace. Weps and the XO get annoyed with him sometimes."
"Why?" Gregory asked.
"Because he talks like you, sir," Senior Chief Leak answered. "But he ain't in your pay grade."
"He's a good kid, though," Senior Chief Matson observed. "Takes good care of his troops, and he knows his stuff, doesn't he, Tim?"
"Yeah, George, good kid. Going places if he stays in."
"He won't. Computer companies are already trying to recruit him. Shit, Compaq offered him 300 big ones last week."
"That's a living wage," Chief Leak commented.
"What did Dennis say?"
"He said no. I told him to hold out for half a mil."
Matson laughed as he reached for some coffee.
"What do you think, Dr. Gregory? The kid worth that kind of money in the pewter business?"
"If he can do really good code, maybe," Al replied, making a mental note to check out this Lieutenant Olson himself.
TRW always had room for talent. Dartmouth was known for its computer science department. Add field experience to that, and you had a real candidate for the ongoing SAM project.
"Okay, if you insert the chip, what happens?"
"Then you change the range of the radar. You know how it works. The RF energy goes out forever on its own, but we only accept signals that bounce back within a specific time gate. This..."
Senior Chief Leak held up a floppy disk with a hand-printed label on it.
"Changes the gate. It extends the effective range of the spy out to, 2,000 kilometers. Damn sight farther than the missiles'll go. I was on Port Royal out at Kwajalein 5 years ago doing a theater missile test, and we were tracking the inbound from the time it popped over the horizon all the way in."
"You hit it?" Gregory asked with immediate interest. Leak shook his head.
"Guidance fin failure on the bird. It was an early Block 4. We got within 50 meters, but that was a cunt hair outside the warhead's kill perimeter, and they only allowed us one shot, for some reason or other nobody ever told me about. Shiloh got a kill the next year. Splattered it with a skin-skin kill. The video of that one is a son of a bitch," the senior chief assured his guest.
Gregory believed it. When an object going one way at 14,000 miles per hour got hit by something going the other way at 2,000 miles per hour, the result could be quite impressive.
"First round hit?" he asked.
"You bet. The sucker was coming straight at us, and this baby doesn't miss much." "We always clean up with vandal tests off Wallops Island,"
Chief Mattson confirmed.
What are those exactly?
Old Talos Sams, Mattson explained. Big stovepipes, ramjet engines. They can come in on a ballistic track at about 2,200 miles per hour. Pretty hot on the deck, too. That's what we worry about. The Russians came out with a sea skimmer we call Sunburn.
Aegis killer, some folks call it, Chief Leak added. Low and fast.
But we ain't missed one yet, Mattson announced. The Aegis system's pretty good. So, Dr. Gregory, what exactly are you checking out?
I want to see if your system can be used to stop a ballistic inbound.
How fast? Mattson asked.
A for-real ICBM.
When you detect it on radar, it'll be doing about 17,000 miles per hour. Call it 7,600 meters per second.
That's real fast, Leak observed. 7, 8 times the speed of a rifle bullet.
Faster in a theater ballistic weapon like a Scud. Not sure we can do it, Mattson worried.
This radar system will track it just fine. It's very similar to the Cobra Dane system in the Aleutians. Question is, can your SAMs react fast enough to get a hit?
How hard's the target? Mattson asked.
Softer than an aircraft. The RV's designed to withstand heat, not an impact. Like the space shuttle. When you fly it through a rainstorm, it plays hell with the tiles.
Oh, yeah?
Yep, Gregory nodded.
Like styrofoam coffee cups.
Okay, so then the problem's getting the SM-2 close enough to have the warhead pop off when the target's in the fragmentation cone.
Correct.
They might be enlisted men, Gregory thought, but that didn't make them dumb.
Software fix in the seeker head, right?
Also correct. I've rewritten the code. Pretty easy job, really. I reprogrammed the way the laser mutates. Ought to work okay if the infrared homing system works as advertised. At least it did in the computer simulations up in Washington.
It worked just fine on Shiloh, Doc. We got the videotape aboard somewhere, Leak assured him. Want to see it?
You bet, Dr. Gregory said with enthusiasm.
Okay.
Senior Chief Leak checked his watch.
I'm free now. Let me head aft for a smoke, and then we'll roll the videotape, he said, sounding like Warner Wolf on WCBS New York.
You can't smoke in here?
Leak grunted annoyance.
It's the new Navy, Doc. The captain's a health Nazi. You gotta go aft to light up.
Not even in Chief's quarters, Leak groused.
I quit, Mattson said. Not a pussy like Tim here.
My ass, Leak responded. There's a few real men left aboard.
How come you sit sideways here? Gregory asked, rising to his feet to follow them aft. The important displays go to the right side of the ship instead of fore and aft. How come?
'Cause it helps you puke if you're in a seaway, Mattson laughed. Whoever designed these ships didn't like sailors much, but at least the air conditioning works.
It rarely got above 60 degrees in the CIC, causing most of the men who worked there to wear sweaters. Aegis cruisers were decidedly not known for their comforts.
"This is serious?" Colonel Aliyev asked.
It was a stupid question, and he knew it. But it just had to come out anyway, and his commander knew that.
"We have orders to treat it that way, Colonel," Bondarenko replied crossly. "What do we have to stop them?"
"The 265th Motor Rifle Division is at roughly 50% combat efficiency," the theater operations officer replied.
"Beyond that, 2 tank regiments at 40% or so. Our reserve formations are mostly theoretical," Aliyev concluded.
"Our air assets, 1 regiment of fighter interceptors ready for operations, another 3 who don't have even half their aircraft fit to fly."
Bondarenko nodded at the news. It was better than it had been upon his arrival in theater, and he'd done well to bring things that far. But that wouldn't impress the Chinese very much.
"Opposition?" he asked next.
Far East's intelligence officer was another colonel, Vladimir Konstantinovich Tolkunov.
"Our Chinese neighbors are in good military shape, Comrade General.
The nearest enemy formation is 34th Shock Army, a Type A group army commanded by General Peng Shiwang, he began, showing off what he knew. That one formation has triple or more our mechanized assets and is well-trained. Chinese aircraft? Well, their tactical aircraft number over 2,000, and we must assume they will commit everything to this operation. Comrades, we do not have anything like the assets we need to stop them.
So we will use space to our advantage, the general proposed. Of that we have much. We will fight a holding action and await reinforcements from the west. I'll be talking with Stavka later today. Let's draw up what we'll need to stop these barbarians.
All down one line of railroad, Aliyev observed. And our fucking engineers have been busily clearing a route for the Chinks to take to the oil fields. General, first of all, we need to get our engineers working on minefields. We have millions of mines, and the route the Chinese will take is easily predicted. The overall problem was that the Chinese had strategic, if not tactical, surprise. The former was a political exercise, and like Hitler in 1941, the Chinese had pulled it off. At least Bondarenko would have tactical warning, which was more than Stalin had allowed his Red Army. He also expected to have freedom of maneuver, because, also unlike Stalin, his President Grushevoy would be thinking with his brain instead of his balls. With freedom of maneuver, Bondarenko would have the room to play a mobile war with his enemy, denying the Chinese a chance at decisive engagement, allowing hard contact only when it served his advantage. Then he'd be able to wait for reinforcements to give him a chance to fight a set-piece battle on his own terms, at a place and time of his choosing.
How good are the Chinese really, Pavel?
The People's Liberation Army has not engaged in large-scale combat operations in over 50 years, since the Korean War with the Americans, unless you cite the border clashes we had with them in the late '60s and early '70s. In that case, the Red Army dealt with them well. But to do that we had massive firepower, and the Chinese were only fighting for limited objectives. They are trained largely on our old model. Their soldiers will not have the ability to think for themselves.
Their discipline is worse than draconian. The smallest infraction can result in summary execution, and that makes for obedience.
At the operational level, their general officers are well trained in theoretical terms. Qualitatively, their weapons are roughly the equal of ours. With their greater funding, their training levels mean that their soldiers are intimately familiar with their weapons and rudimentary tactics, Zhdanov told the assembled staff. But they are probably not our equal in operational maneuver thinking. Unfortunately, they do have numbers going for them, and quantity has a quality of its own, as the NATO armies used to say of us. What they will want to do, and what I fear they will, is try to roll over us quickly. Just crush us and move on to their political and economic objectives as quickly as possible.
Bondarenko nodded as he sipped his tea.
This was mad. And the maddest part of all was that he was playing the role of a NATO commander from 1975. Maybe a German one, which was truly insane. Faced with adverse numbers, but blessed, as the Germans had not been, with space to play with. And Russians had always used space to their advantage. He leaned forward.
Very well. Comrades, we will deny them the opportunity for decisive engagement. If they cross the border, we will fight a maneuver war. We will sting and move. We will hurt them and withdraw before they can counterattack. We will give them land, but we will not give them blood. The life of every single one of our soldiers is precious to us. The Chinese have a long way to go to their objectives. We will let them go a lot of that way, and we will bide our time and husband our men and equipment. We will make them pay for what they take. But we will not, we must not, give them the chance to catch our forces in decisive battle. Are we understood on that? He asked his staff. When in doubt, we will run away and deny the enemy what he wants. When we have what we need to strike back, we will make him wish he never heard of Russia. But until then, let him chase his butterflies.
What of the border guards? Aliyev asked.
They will hurt the Chinese, and then they will pull out. Comrades, I cannot emphasize this enough. The life of every single private soldier is important to us. Our men will fight harder if they know we care about them, and more than that, they deserve our care and solicitude. If we ask them to risk their lives for their country must be loyal to them in return. If we achieve that, they will fight like tigers. The Russian soldier knows how to fight. We must all be worthy of him. You are all skilled professionals. This will be the most important test of our lives. We must all be equal to our task. Our nation depends on us. Andrei Petrovich, draw up some plans for me. We are authorized to call up reserves. Let us start doing that. We have hectares of equipment for them to use. Unlock the gates and let them start drawing gear, and God permit the officers assigned to those cadres are worthy of their men. Dismissed.
Bondarenko stood and walked out, hoping his declamation had been enough for the task. But wars were not won by speeches. Chapter 45 Ghosts of Horrors Past. President Grushevoy arrived in Warsaw with the usual pomp and circumstance. A good actor, Ryan saw, watching the arrival on TV. You never would have guessed from his face that his country was looking at a major war. Grushevoy passed the same receiving line, doubtless composed of the same troops Ryan had eyeballed on his arrival, made a brief but flowery arrival speech citing the long and friendly history shared by Poland and Russia, conveniently leaving out the equally long and less than friendly parts, then got into a car for the city, accompanied, Ryan was glad to see, by Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko. In the president's hand was a fax from Washington outlining what the Chinese had in the way of war assets to turn loose on their northern neighbors, along with an estimate from the Defense Intelligence Agency on what they called the correlation of forces, which, Jack remembered, was a term of art used by the Soviet Army of old. Its estimate of the situation was not especially favorable. Almost as bad, America didn't have much with which to help the Russians. The world's foremost navy was of little direct use in a land war. The United States Army had a division and a half of heavy troops in Europe, but that was thousands of miles from the expected scene of action. The Air Force had all the mobility it needed to project force anywhere on the globe, and that could give anyone a serious headache. But airplanes could not by themselves defeat an army. No, this would be largely a Russian show, and the Russian army, the fact said, was in terrible shape. The DIA had some good things to say about the senior Russian commander in theater, but a smart guy with a 22 against a dumb one with a machine gun was still at a disadvantage. So he hoped the Chinese would be taken aback by this day's news, but CIA and the state's estimate of that possibility was decidedly iffy.
"Scott?" Ryan asked his Secretary of State.
"Jack, I can't say. This ought to discourage them, but we can't be sure how tight a corner they think they are in. If they think they're trapped, they might still lash out."
"God damn it, Scott, is this the way nations do business?" Jack demanded. "Misperceptions? Fears? Outright stupidity?"
Adler shrugged. "It's a mistake to think a chief of government is any smarter than the rest of us, Jack. People make decisions the same way, regardless of how big and smart they are. It comes down to how they perceive the question, and how best they can serve their own needs. Preserve their own personal well-being. Remember that we're not dealing with clergymen here. They don't have much in the way of consciences. Our notion of right and wrong doesn't play in that sort of mind. They translate what's good for their country into what's good for themselves, just like a king in the 12th century. But in this case, there isn't any bishop around to remind them that there may be a god looking down at them with a notebook." They'd gone out of their way, Adler didn't have to say, to eliminate a cardinal archbishop just to get themselves into this mess.
"Sociopaths?" the president asked.
Secretary Adler shrugged. "I'm not a physician, just a diplomat. When you negotiate with people like this, you dangle what's good for their country, them, in front of their eyes and hope they reach for it. You play the game without entirely understanding them. These people do things neither one of us would ever do. And they run a major country, complete with nuclear weapons."
"Great,"
Ryan breathed. He stood and got his coat.
"Well, let's go watch our new ally sign up, shall we?"
10 minutes later, they were in the reception room of the Lazienski Palace. There was the usual off-camera time for the various chiefs of government to socialize over Perrier with a twist before some nameless protocol official opened the double doors to the table, chairs, documents, and TV cameras. The speech from President Grushevoy was predictable in every detail. The NATO alliance had been established to protect Western Europe against what his country had once been, and his former country had established its own mirror-image alliance called the Warsaw Pact right here in this very city. But the world had turned, and now Russia was pleased to join the rest of Europe in an alliance of friends whose only wish was peace and prosperity for all. Grushevoy was pleased indeed to be the first Russian in a very long time to be a real part of the European community, and promised to be a worthy friend and partner of his newly close neighbors. The military ramifications of the North Atlantic Treaty were not mentioned at all. And everyone present applauded. And Grushevoy pulled out an ancient fountain pen borrowed from the collection at the Hermitage in St. Petersburg to sign in the name of his country, and so bring membership in NATO up by one. And everyone applauded again as the various chiefs of state and government walked over to shake their new ally's hand. And the shape of the world changed yet again.
"Ivan Nemitovich," Golovko said, as he approached the American president.
"Sergei Nikolaevich," Ryan said in quiet reply.
"What will Beijing think of this?" the chief of the Russian intelligence service asked.
"With luck, we'll know in 24 hours, Ryan answered, knowing that this ceremony had gone out on CNN's live global feed, and positive that it was being watched in China.
"I expect the language will be profane."
"They've said nasty things about me lately," Jack assured him.
"That you should have carnal relations with your mother, no doubt."
"Actually, that I should have oral sex with her," the president confirmed distastefully. "I suppose everybody says things like that in private."
"In person, it can get a man shot."
Ryan grunted grim semi-amusement.
"Bet your ass, Sergei."
"Will this work?" Golovko asked.
"I was going to ask you that. You're closer to them than we are."
"I do not know," the Russian said, with a tiny sip of his vodka glass.
"And if it does not?"
"In that case, you have some new allies."
"And what of the precise wording of Articles 5 and 6 of the treaty?"
"Sergei, you may tell your president that the United States will regard an attack on any part of the territory of the Russian Federation as operative under the North Atlantic Treaty. On that, Sergei Nikolaevich, you have the word and the commitment of the United States of America," Swordsman told his Russian acquaintance.
"Jack, if I may address you in this way, I have told my president more than once that you are a man of honor and a man of your word."
The relief on his face was obvious.
"Sergei, from you those words are flattering." "It's simple, really. It's your land, and a nation like ours cannot just stand by and watch a robbery of this scale taking place. It corrupts the foundations of international peace. It's our job to remake the world into a peaceful place. There's been enough war."
"I fear there will be another," Golovko said, with characteristic honesty.
"Then together your country and mine will make it the very last."
"Plato said only the dead have seen the end of war."
"So are we to be bound by the words of a Greek who lived 25 centuries ago?"
"I prefer the words of a Jew who lived 5 centuries later."
"It's time, Sergei. It's fucking time," Ryan said forcefully.
"I hope you're right. You Americans always so madly optimistic."
"There's a reason for that."
"Oh, what would that be?" the Russian asked.
Jack fixed his eyes on his Russian colleague. "In my country all things are possible. They will be in your country, too, if you just allow it. Embrace democracy, Sergei. Embrace freedom. Americans are not genetically different from the rest of the world. We're mongrels. We have the blood of every country on earth in our veins. The only thing different between us and the rest of the world is our constitution. Just a set of rules. That's all, Sergei, but it has served us well. You've been studying us for how long?
Since I joined the KGB, over 35 years.
And what have you learned of America and how it works? Ryan asked.
Obviously not enough, Golovko answered honestly. The spirit of your country has always puzzled me.
Because it's too simple. You were looking for complexity. We allow people to pursue their dreams, and when the dreams succeed, we reward them. Others see that happen and chase after their own dreams.
But the class issues?
What class issues? Sergei, not everybody goes to Harvard.
I didn't, remember.
My father was a cop. I was the first guy in my family to finish college. Look how I turned out. Sergei, we do not have class distinctions in America. You can be what you choose to be if you are willing to work at it. You can succeed or you can fail.
Luck helps, Ryan admitted, but it comes down to work. All Americans have stars in their eyes, the chairman of the SVR observed tersely.
The better to see the heavens, Ryan responded.
Perhaps. Just so they don't come crashing down on us.
So, what does this mean for us? Xu Kunpiao asked, in an entirely neutral voice. Zhang Hansan and his premier had been watching the CNN feed in the latter's private office, complete with simultaneous translation through headphones now discarded. The senior minister without portfolio made a dismissive wave of the hand.
I've read the North Atlantic Treaty, he said. It does not apply to us at all. Articles 5 and 6 limit its military application to events in Europe and North America only.
All right, it includes Turkey, and, as originally written, Algeria, which was part of France in 1949. For incidents at sea, it applies only to the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea, and then only north of the Tropic of Cancer. Otherwise, the NATO countries would have been compelled to join in the Korean War and Vietnam on the American side. Those things did not happen because the treaty did not apply outside its defined area.
Nor does it apply to us.
Treaty documents have discrete language and discrete application, he reminded his party chief. They are not open-ended.
I am concerned even so, Xu responded.
Hostilities are not activities to be undertaken lightly, Zhang admitted. But the real danger to us is economic collapse and the resulting social chaos. That, comrade, could bring down our entire social order. And that is something we cannot risk. But when we succeed in seizing the oil and gold, we need not worry about such things. With our own abundant oil supply, we will not face an energy crisis. And with gold we can buy anything we require from the rest of the world.
My friend, you must understand the West. They worship money. And they base their economies on oil. With those two things, they must do business with us.
Why did America intervene in the Kuwait affair? Oil. Why did Britain, France, and all the other nations join in?
Oil.
He who has oil is their friend. We shall have oil.
It is that simple, Zhang concluded.
You are very confident. The minister nodded.
Yes, Xu, I am, because I have studied the West for many years. The way they think is actually very predictable.
The purpose of this treaty might be to frighten us, I suppose, but it is at most a paper tiger. Even if they wished to provide military assistance to Russia, they do not have the ability to do so. And I do not believe that they have that wish. They cannot know our plans, because if they did, they would have pressed their advantage over us in terms of currency reserves at the trade talks.
But they did not, did they? Zhang asked.
Is there no way they could know?
It is most unlikely. Comrade Tan has no hint of foreign espionage in our country at anything approaching a high level, and his sources in Washington and elsewhere have not caught a sniff of such information being available to them.
Then why did they just broaden NATO? Xu demanded.
Is it not obvious? Russia is becoming rich with oil and gold, and the capitalist states wish to partake in the Russians' good fortune.
That is what they said in the press, isn't it?
It is fully in keeping with the capitalist ethos, mutual greed.
Who can say perhaps in 5 years they will invite us into NATO for the same reason? Zhang observed with an ironic leer.
You are confident that our plans have not been compromised?
As we come to a higher alert level and begin moving troops, we may expect some reaction from the Russians.
But the rest of them?
Bah!
Tan and Marshal Luo are confident as well.
Very well, Xu said, not entirely persuaded, but agreeing even so.
It was morning in Washington. Vice President Jackson was de facto boss of the crisis management team, a place assured by his previous job, Director of Operations, J3, for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. One nice thing about the White House was the good security, made better still by bringing people in via helicopter and car, and by the fact that the Joint Chiefs could teleconference in from their meeting room, the tank, over a secure fiber-optic link.
Well, Jackson asked, looking at the large television on the wall of the Situation Room.
Mancuso has his people at work in Hawaii. The Navy can give the Chinese a bad time, and the Air Force can move a lot of assets to Russia if need be, said Army General Mickey Moore, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. It's the land side of the equation that has me worried. We could theoretically move one heavy division, first armored, from Germany east, along with some attachments, and maybe NATO will join in with some additional stuff. But the Russian army is in miserable shape at the moment, especially in the Far East. And there's also the additional problem that China has 12 CSS-4 intercontinental ballistic missiles. We figure 8 or more of them are aimed at us.
Tell me more, Tomcat ordered.
They're Titan II clones. Hell, Moore went on, I just found out the background earlier today. They were designed by a Caltech-educated Air Force colonel of Chinese ethnicity who defected over there in the 1950s. Some bonehead trumped up some security charges against him. Turned out they were all bullshit, would you believe? And he bugged out with a few suitcases worth of technical information right out of JPL, where he was working at the time. So the Chi-Coms built what were virtually copies of the old Martin Marietta missile, and, like I said, we figure 8 of them are aimed back at us.
Warheads?
5 megaton is our best guess. City busters. The birds are bitches to maintain, just like ours were. We figure they're kept defueled most of the time, and they probably need 2 to 4 hours to bring them up to launch readiness. That's the good news. The bad news is that they upgraded the protection on the silos over the last decade, probably as a result of what we did in the Iraq bombing campaign, and also the B-2 strikes into Japan on their SS-19 clones. The current estimate is that the covers are 15 feet of rebarred concrete, plus 3 feet of armor-class steel. We don't have a conventional bomb that'll penetrate that.
Why not? Jackson demanded in considerable surprise.
Because the GBU-29 we cobbled together to take out that deep bunker in Baghdad was designed to hang on the F-111. It's the wrong dimensions for the B-2's bomb bay, and the 111s are all at the boneyard in Arizona. So we have the bombs, okay, but nothing to deliver them with. Best option to take those silos out would be air-launched cruise missiles with W-80 warheads, assuming the President will authorize a nuclear strike on them.
What warning will we have that the Chinese have prepared the missiles for launch?
Not much, Moore admitted. The new silo configuration pretty well prevents that. The silo covers are massive beasts. We figure they plan to blow them off with explosives like we used to do.
Do we have